Darkwraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2013. Lecture 18, delivered on October 28, 2013. The title of this lecture is Capital Budgeting Decision Making.
Today, Capital Budgeting Decision Making. Capital Budgeting Decision Making, we are determining whether we are going to go with a new project or not go with it. Some project has been brought to us, a new project, and what we have to ask ourselves is whether or not this project is worth our time to go with. If it is going to bring in more money than it is going to cost us. So as a simple example, now have your calculators out. Because you can do this the hard way, or you can do this the easy way. The calculator will make it so that this is one of those very easy projects. A project that costs $5,000 now will bring in extra cash flow of $2,100 the first year, $3,200 the second year, and end with a salvage value on the equipment of $100. Question is this an up or a down? Well, obviously, this project is going to bring in, it looks like, $5,400. Cost $5,000, great. Except that that doesn't take into account the time value of money, so we need to discount these cash flows out there back to now. So what's going to happen here is that we have now, zero. And at time zero, we are going to punch out a check for $5,000. And then at year one, we're going to see in cash inflow of $2,100. And then the project will live a little longer out to year two. And in its second year, its last year, it'll push in out to $3,200. But then also, we can unload the equipment for about $100. So I'm bringing this up right now so you never forget. If I say a salvage value, just add it to the last year's cash flow. Just put it on the last year's cash flow, okay? Sometimes I'll say there was no salvage value, but actually, typically in business operations, there is a salvage value. And I see that in my business. You know, my old equipment, when I'm going to replace it or I'm going to add new, what I do is I sell the old equipment and I get some estimate, figure out, okay, what's this going to cost? What am I going to get for this when I sell it? That kind of thing. Okay. So what we need to do is to bring back these two positive cash flows to the present. and take their present values and add them to the negative value there and see if we've got a positive number. If it's positive, yes. If it's negative, no. If it's a dollar positive, yes. If it's a dollar negative, no. But in order to do that, we're going to need a discount rate. Now, typically, you're either going to sort of have one in mind that you use. Some companies say, always use this discount rate. Or you might use the capital asset pricing model, figure out what the risk of this project is, and get a beta that way. So for these purposes right here, let's say that we're going to discount the cash flows at 8%, 8.5%. Now, you can do this the painful way. Take the present value 1 year out of $2,100 plus the present value 2 years out of $3,300. Not too bad for this one, but what if you got a project that's going on for 10 years? That gets to be a lot like work. Here's how you do it on your happy little calculator, that TI-83 plus or TI-84. First, turn on the calculator. And I say, oh, duh. Okay. Hit apps, finance, and go down to NPV, or just type in 7. So it's apps, finance, and go down, or just key in the number 7, which is NPV. What's going to happen when you do that is that you're going to come back to your main screen where you'll see NPV and an open parenthesis. And there's where you start keying in your numbers. First, you're going to put in the interest rate, 8.5, as an interest rate, as a percentage. Remember, this is what monkey see, monkey do. You would use 0.085 if you were doing math, but this is a calculator. Then you key in a comma. Then you key in the negative amount that you're pushing out. In this case, negative 5,000. And use the negative key, not the minus key. And then you put in a comma, and you open braces. Now that is second parenthesis. And this is where you put in your cash flows, one after the other. 2,100, comma, 3,300. And when you finish putting them in, no matter how many there are, when you finish putting them in, close the braces and then close the parenthesis and hit enter. That's all there is to it to calculate net present value. Apps, finance, 7. Now I'm going to do this. I just did it, and I want to make sure I got the same answer twice. Minus 5,000, open braces, oops, comma, open. Did I put a comma there? Yeah, comma, open braces, and then 2,100, comma, 3,300, close the braces, close the parenthesis. What do you get? Negative $261.31. So this project is a no-go. It's a no-go. We're not going to do this project because the project is negative. A review of this. This method is still used. It is timeless. Now, there are some new methods that have kind of come along, and in the advanced financial theory and practice course, which I'm sure you'll all want to take from me one day, you'll see new methods. But honestly, even at the core of those new methods, we're still doing this. And in normal project analysis, this is how we do it. We just figure out the net present value of the future expected cash flows. And that's the end of the matter. If it's negative, no. If it's positive, yes. And it just boils down to that. Now these are almost like no-brainers on a quiz that'll be coming up and on your next exam. They're just like, just key in the numbers. Make sure, as I said, that you remember to put in that that salvage value. It's always tacked onto your last cash flow. And this is how capital budgeting is done. However, there's an alternative. And it's actually intimately connected to this method right here. I'm going to show you something. Okay, I'm going to draw an axis, NPV, and on this axis, the discount rate that we use. And I'm going to show you something here. Give me a second here. NPV, let's do 51, 152, 253, negatives of that 2 on the vertical axis to show you what the point of this is. Okay, now let's do 1%, 2%, 3%, 4%, 5%, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. And this is $50 here. Now, what we found out over there was that if I use a discount rate of 8.5%, I find out that at 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8.5%, I've got an NPV of about negative $260 right there. Okay. Now, do this. I want you you don't have to rekey it all in. Some of you already know this. Hit second entry. That brings your formula back up. Now go up into the formula and simply where you saw the 8.5, go over there and just make, let's say, 7.0. It'll just overwrite. If you don't want it to overwrite, you put insert. You key in insert first, second mode. But here, just replace it with 7.5, then go back down and hit enter. What do you get? Got it? What do you get? Call it. Negative 155. So in other words, backing back to 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, we get to an NPV of negative 155, right about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. All right, yeah, about there. Let me fix this a little bit. Okay.
That's the only thing you changed
just the interest rate, just the discount rate. That's all I did. Notice that as the discount rate goes down, you're actually getting a smaller negative NPV. Let's get down. Go back, hit second entry, and go up there to that 7. Let's change that to a 3%. Let's see what the NPV is at 3%. Oh. At 3%, it's a positive NPV of $149. So at a positive, at 3%, what was it? $149, thank you. $149, right about there. Well, that's interesting. So in other words, the net present value is a line that goes that with a negative slope, the higher the discount rate,
the lower the net present value. So it looks like there's a discount rate right there that makes the net present value exactly zero. We have a name for that. It's called the internal rate of return. Now, if I'm looking at this, talk to me. What does it look like that IRR is? Just eyeball. What does it look like? Yeah, what is it? What is the number? What do you see? 5%. My, it is? Really? It's a little bit above 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. It looks like it's about 5.2%, maybe. Well, let's find out exactly what it is. Go back to your calculator. Now, I want you to key in Apps, Finance, go down or just key in the number 8, and out comes the IRR. Put in negative 5,000, comma, open the braces, what was it, 2,100? Comma, 3,300, close the braces, close the parenthesis. Shows you how good my straight lines are. What do you get? What's the number that spits out? Good. That just goes to show you what happens when you don't use a ruler to do this kind of stuff. That's the internal rate of return. That's the internal rate of return. In other words, that would be the discount rate that makes net present value zero. I want you to remember that because I will ask that on the second exam. What is the internal rate of return? That's exactly a 5-point answer. Give him a cookie. What is the internal rate of return? It's the discount rate that makes the net present value zero. That's all you have to say to make my heart warm and my pants damp. Okay? Don't get fancy with these answers. It's straight up. Now, I'm going to tell you, the internal rate of return net present value is technically a better method. Here's how internal rate of return is used. A lot of times, you'll hear this, not a lot, but in some companies, you'll hear this term hurdle rate. Hurdle rate. The hurdle rate is essentially somewhere in the company's decision making. They say all projects must meet or exceed this hurdle rate. Okay? It's actually kind of connected to this internal rate of return concept, sort of. So if I were to tell you, okay, I know that the internal rate of return of this project is 4.91%. Okay, we're going to discount this. I know that in the back of my mind. Someone says, okay, discount this project to 4%. You don't have to do anything as far as the calculator goes. You'll immediately say accept. You'll immediately say, accept this project. Again, if someone says, well, we found that the internal rate of return is 4.91%. and then someone comes to you and says, discount the cash flows from this project at 4%, I'll say, we accept. I don't even need to do the calculator because I know that if the internal rate of return is 4.9% and someone is telling me to discount the cash flows at 4%, I know it's going to be a positive net present value project right off the bat. I know it right there. That's it. There's no reason to try to calculate anything because if your discount rate is below the internal rate of return, then you accept the project. Again, if the discount rate is below the internal rate of return, it's going to be a positive net present value. I don't know what the number is, but that doesn't matter. It's positive, so you accept. That's all there is to it. That's how we make the decision. Now, I'm going to tell you, in the book, they go through a couple of old methods. I hope you'll never actually see these in practice because they're completely repudiated, and the book tells you these are completely invalid. But there's one called payback method, the payback period. Don't ever use it, and don't even bother to read about it in the book. I won't ever ask about it. And if you ever actually work for a company where they're using the payback method, just kill yourself. You know what the sad part is? I actually ran into a company last year that's still using payback method. Let me show you what payback period and all that. Let's say you got a project that's going to cost $10,000. And here's its cash inflow for years 1, 2, 3, and 4. It's going to cost you 10 grand out the door, and then you're going to have $3,000 coming in year 1, 5 grand in year 2, 4 grand in year 3, 2 grand in year 4, and a grand in year 5. So the payback method simply says the company decides that all projects must pay back the initial investment within a certain number of years. Now, this is not that company, but that company said, we want all projects to pay back within 2 years. And then the method goes like this. Okay, this company, this project pays in $3,000 in year one. By the end of year two, it's paid in $8,000. By the end of year three, it's paid in $12,000. Oh, well, this project didn't pay itself off within 2 years, so we reject it. It's an old, old method, and I thought it was completely dead until I saw it being used. I heard this finance guy said, well, the payback period on it is past our policy. So in other words, that this project right here, you could think of almost any discount rate. That project is a go. It's a good go. But by the payback method, it's rejected because it didn't pay off within the payback period. So it's rejected. Don't use payback method. They show it in the book. They point out that it's completely worthless. Don't even bother with it. Now, there's another method, IRR. Now, let me tell you something about IRR. There's a problem with internal rate of return. It's kind of subtle, and it has to do with what would happen if you had a project that had more than one switch in the sign of the cash flows. See, the way we usually assume things is there's going to be only one switch in the cash flow sign. There's going to be out-the-door money at the beginning, negative, and then from there on, there will be positive money coming in. Now, if that's not the case, if, like, say, in year four, you have to put a big pile more money into the project, well, net present value has no problem with that at all. Unfortunately, internal rate of return does something completely bizarre. If there's more than one sign switch, internal rate of return gives you multiple answers, depending upon where you start looking for the crossing. So in other words, if there's only one sign switch, the function has one root. You remember that from math. But if there's more than one sign switch, the internal rate of return has multiple roots. So wherever the calculator starts looking, it will find one. But there's another one here. There might be another one up there. In other words, the IRR is meaningless. It has no interpretation. That's why we tend to just kind of stay away from internal rate of return. And it's just, that's just the way it is. The book goes into some fancy details when you should use IRR, when you should use NPV. Generally, the rule is stick with the NPV. The IRR is useful. It's nice, and it's good to know it if there's one IRR. If someone tells you an internal rate of return, make sure that analysis was done on some project that had only one switch in the sign of the cash flows. If that's the case, then the internal rate of return is a quick, dirty method to know whether to accept or reject projects based on a discount rate. That's all there is to it. There's a couple of other things here, too. Kind of straightforward. Two different kinds of projects. Independent projects and mutually exclusive projects. Ideally, a company can take on whatever projects are positive NPV. And that's what you should be doing. If the world is full of positive NPV projects, well, certainly we should just grab as many of them as we can possibly find capital to finance. Just keep going. But oddly enough, there are some times when taking on one project means you have to give up another project. So in other words, usually projects are independent. You take one on, that doesn't do anything to stop another one. But once in a great while, there are two projects where if you take on one, the other one, you shouldn't bother, you can't do. Can you think of some way, sometime, where that could happen? Can you imagine where that could happen? Yeah.
Something with a competitor, if you take on a job with one competitor of a market and then work with the same.
Oh, now that's an interesting possibility. I actually had not thought of that. But yeah, you could have essentially what would be called What's the term? I can't think of the term for it, but there is a term for that. But yeah, that could happen. And that was one that caught me. Yeah, you caught me by surprise. The one that a lot of times comes to mind is we've got a piece of land that we want to do some projects. But you can't do more than one project if you have one piece of land to use. You've got a factory, okay? We can do two different things with this floor space, but we can't do both of them with the same floor space. Things like that, that would happen. So there are times when there's mutually exclusive projects. And in cases like that, the first thing that you would want to do is figure out what each project's NPV and IRR were, okay? With mutual exclusive, you just work out each project on its own. See what the NPV is, see what the IRR is. Now, what can happen rarely is that you might get two projects, A and B, NPV, IRR. The NPV of Project A is positive $3,400. The NPV of Project B is positive $2,400. The internal rate of return on Project A is 10.8%. The internal rate of return on project B is 14.5%. Oh my, it can happen. Project A has a higher NPV than project B. That would tell you right off the bat, okay, let's take on project A. We can't take them both on, so we'll take on the one that has higher NPV. But if you turn it around and look at the IRRs, well, project A kind of sucks compared to project B. Project B has a higher NPV, higher IRR way out. So in other words, what we're looking at here, what we're basically looking at here is the two projects. One of them has an NPV that looks, that its profile function looks like that. The other one, strangely enough, looks like that. So that one is A, that one is B. So in other words, A hits at a lower point on the horizontal axis than B hits. But whatever the discount rate was that we used to get the NPVs, A is $3,400, B is $2,400. Isn't that interesting? What do? Which one do you take? Remember my rule, I said, well, you know, if you choose between NPV and IRR, always go with NPV. But maybe that's not the idea here. So which one would you take on? You can't take them both on. You've done this analysis that gives you conflicting decision-making. So what do you do in this case? Do you go with the one that has a higher net present value at whatever discount rate you use for it? Or do you go with the one that gave you a higher internal rate of return? Any thought? Well, that's an interesting point right there. That's well taken. You're absolutely right that, I mean, if one of them is going to cost $50,000 and the other is going to cost $8,000, I don't know. Maybe you'd have to take that into account, your capital constraint. You're absolutely right. Now, shut up. You shot my lecture there. That's a good point, though. Here's what I would argue, and this is disputed by some, but I think the book agrees with me on this, I think, is in a case like this, I would probably go with the internal rate of return. Here's why. Do you see how Project B has a positive NPV for more interest rates, more discount rates than Project A? Do you see that? So in other words, first of all, suppose that the discount rate I chose for NPV was wrong. B is more insensitive to that incorrectness. Second, suppose interest rates swing. And what would have been the right interest rate now is too low later on to use for discounting. Do you see how B actually is what we say, and this is a term you should learn how to use. Project B is more robust to the chosen discount rate. Project B is more robust to the chosen discount rate. What that means is that you can have more flexibility, more wrongness in your discount rate that you chose for NPV, and you can still have a winner of a project. There's a little bit of art as well as science in what I'm saying to you here, but it's a judgment call. I know people who just say, well, NPV always NPV. But in my judgment, and like I said, I think the book agrees with me on this, with mutual exclusive projects, go with the IRR. Because it's simply telling you, well, there's a lot more chance for survival of the project even if interest rates go up, and I should have used a higher discount rate. Even a higher discount rate. See, project A, if my discount rate is wrong by a little bit, or if discount rates go up because of macroeconomic conditions, well, project A goes sour pretty darn quickly. Project E doesn't go sour quickly, nearly as fast, if I'm wrong or if discount rates go up. So that's why for mutually exclusive projects, and sometimes I do this on exam two, one of these, two projects are mutually exclusive, blah, blah, blah. That would be the one that you would use for it. The one thing that I do want to point out about what we're doing here is that when you do project analysis, you want to always be looking at incremental cash flow. When you write down these numbers for this, for your NPVs, you want to look at only how much extra money a project is going to bring into the company. How much extra money a project is going to bring into the company. And that can actually be a little bit complicated. And there are two reasons for this. First of all, sometimes it's easy. What extra revenue is going to come into a company? You know, how much more money are we going to make in sales? But at the same time, you always have to be careful that if you're doing, like for consumer products, if I do this new product, am I going to bleed off revenue from another product that I have? If that is going to be the case, then you need to be real about that happening, and you need to knock down your cash flows by how much you lose on your existing product lines. Companies work really hard to try their best to segment their markets so that they aren't cannibalizing their own kind, but it still happens. A company that comes out with a new kind of shampoo, well, that's great, but is that going to hurt the sales of their existing shampoos? We're going to come out with a new line of jeans for women. Well, that's great. Let's see how much money we make, how much our sales will be off those. But we then say, are women who are buying one of our existing lines of jeans going to stop buying those and start buying these? If that's the case, then the loss of sales from the line that is already out there has to be included as a negative in the revenues that we are going to get from the line that we're bringing out now, we're rolling out now. We see that this is really important. Have any of you ever, I don't know if you've been around long enough, cars that were basically like little starter cars maybe 5 years ago, 10 years ago, now are upscale cars or really nice-looking cars. They're better than they used to be. Have you seen any of those? For example, cars like Nissan's Altima. They used to be a little box tin can. Now it's a car. I got in one last week, and it's like, this is almost like luxury. This thing is comfortable as hell. It was so nice, I didn't even want to fart in the car. I'm sitting there, damn, I got to be nice in this car. But the thing is, what they do then is then when they bring in a new entry-level car, the car that was the entry-level doesn't get hit with loss of revenue because they brought that car up to a new class, so it's not going to be hurt. Its sales will not be hurt when they bring in something at the low end again. So whenever you see a car that's like a cheapo starter car now, you pretty much can be assured that within a period of few years, maybe 5 years, that'll be an upscale, a better car, so that they don't have that a new starter car be in a direct competition with the old car, with their existing car line. This goes on all the time in businesses. So when you're thinking about cash flow, and almost all of you at some point in your careers will be involved in these kind of decisions, or you'll have a voice, you always think to yourself and then say it out loud, are we hurting sales of anything else that we sell? If we are, then we have to take that away from the new revenues, the increment off this new project that we're taking on here. And also, don't forget about the problem of opportunity cost. Include in cash flow, you have to be realistic about what you're giving up to get what you're going with. Always include that. And also, don't ever forget about the unseen. Sometimes projects will look like they're a good idea, and they are not a good idea because you haven't thought of everything that can go wrong. I'll give you a very specific example of this. Are any of you here old enough to remember when McDonald's sold pizza? I'm not talking about personal pizzas. Pizzas. Real big family-sized pizzas. They went into the business, and this was some years back. Project analysis, case study. You can see, how much is this going to cost us? Well, okay, we're going to have the cost of pizza ovens. We're going to have the cost of distributor lines for the ingredients for these. We're going to have the cost of training the employees on these. The cost of reprogramming our cash registers so that we've got personal-sized pizzas and full-sized pizzas, some with have it your way, sausage, some with mushrooms, cheese, pepperoni, the works, all of that cost. Okay, now let's talk about the revenue. With the McDonald's brand name behind it, they'll sell like hotcakes because families will eat. We're going to McDonald's for pizza. Yay, pizza! We get fat. Yay! Okay. Positive net present value. It was just straight up financial analysis. Unfortunately, so they put in the ovens. Costly. They did a rollout rather aggressively. Ovens in many of the McDonald's, they got them all up, they got the new menu boards up, got the cash registers reset, and they were ready to go. And by heaven, those pizzas were darn good. I mean, they were seriously decent pizzas. I mean, they gave me the wind, but who cares? They were delicious. And the crust was good. This is not bad at all. But unfortunately, they forgot something. Pull up to the drive-thru.
May I help you, McPlate? Yes, well, I'd like a McPizza. What size? Family size. Thank you.
The pizzas didn't fit through the drive-thru windows. From an outside analyst position, you just sit there, mother of God. Because first, the employees were trying to fold, there was this karate chop, pa, there's your damn pizza. They were angling them, pizza was sliding over, they were hot, gooey, and all that. Will you please pull forward, sir? Okay, we'll solve it. We'll have everyone pull forward. Yeah, you had lines. Backed up, pizzas cooking in the oven because everything had to be fresh. Remember, we have it your way. We'll make it on the spot. Lines backing up, employees having to run out and hand pizzas to irritated people who were sitting there waiting for their noms. It was a fiasco because they forgot to include knocking out the old drive-through windows and putting in new drive-through windows. When they ask themselves, is it going to be worth it to do this, the new project, which would be to knock out drive-through windows, the whole block, the bricks and everything, and put in new ones so the pizzas could go through, It turned out that the incremental cash flows off doing that, their net present value was not as large as the cost of doing that incremental project, that extra project. End of the pizzas, gone. And you were denied the chance to find out just how delicious a McDonald's pizza is. Your lives are so diminished compared to what it was in the past. That's all I have for you. Go home.